Yes, of course. Mother does too. You should see her with him, all timid and submissive, like she needs to bow to him and pamper him because of his genius. I can't understand how she doesn't see it. Is Aunt Madeline going to marry him?
Talia shrugged.
She has the worst taste in men. The worst.
She shook the dice in her hands, seemed to reconsider.
Except for Andreas, I suppose. He's nice. Nice enough. But, of course, she's leaving him. It's always the bastards she falls for.
You mean like your father? She frowns a little.
My father was a stranger she met on her way to Amsterdam. At the train station during a rainstorm, they spent one afternoon together. I have no idea who he is, and neither does she.
Oh.
I remember she said something about her first husband. She said he drank. I just assumed.
Well, that would be Dorian,
Talia said. He was something too.
She moved another checker onto her home board.
He used to beat her. He could go from nice and pleasant to furious in a blink. Like the weather, how it can change suddenly, he was like that. He drank most of the day. Didn't do much but lie around the house. He got real forgetful when he drank. He'd leave the water running, for instance, and flood the house. I remember he forgot to turn off the stove once, and almost burned everything down.
She made a little tower with a stack of chips. Worked quietly for a while, straightening it.
The only thing Dorian really loved was Apollo. All the neighborhood kids were scared of him. Of Apollo, I mean. And hardly any of them had even seen him. They'd only heard his bark. That was enough for them. Dorian kept him chained in the back of the yard, fed him big slabs of lamb.
Talia didn't tell me anymore. I pictured it easily enough, though. Dorian passed out, the dog forgotten, roaming the yard on chain. An open screen door.
How old were you?
I asked in a low voice.
5.
Then I asked the question that had been on my mind since the beginning of summer.
Isn't there something that... I mean, can they do...
Talia snagged her gaze away.
Please don't ask,
she said, heavily, with what I sensed to be a deep ache.
It tires me out. I'm sorry,
I said.
I will tell you someday.
And she did tell me later. The botched surgery, the catastrophic post-op wound infection that turned septic, shut down her kidneys, threw her into liver failure, ate through the neosurgical flap and forced the surgeon to slice off not only the flap, but yet more of what remained of her left cheek and part of her jawbone as well. The complications had kept her in the hospital for nearly 3 months. She'd almost died, should have died. After that, she wouldn't let them touch her again.
Talia,
I said,
I'm sorry too for what happened when we met.
She tipped her eyes up at me. The old playful shine was back.
You should be sorry, but I knew even before you hurled all over the floor.
Knew what?
That you were an ass?
Madeline left 2 days before school started. She wore a tight butter yellow sleeveless dress that clung to her slim frame, horn-rimmed sunglasses, and a firmly knotted white silk scarf to hold down her hair. She was dressed as though she worried parts of her might come loose, like she was literally holding herself together. At the ferry port in Tina's town, she embraced us all. She held Talia the tightest and the longest, her lips on the crown of Talia's head in an extended, unbroken kiss. She didn't take off her sunglasses.
Hug me back,
I heard her whisper. Rigidly, Talia obliged. When the ferry groaned and lurched away, leaving behind a trail of churned-up water, I thought Madeline would stand at the stern and wave and blow us kisses. But she quickly moved toward the bow and took a seat. She didn't look our way. When we got home, Mama told us to sit down. She stood before us and said, "Talia, I want you to know that you don't have to wear that thing in this house anymore. Not on my account, nor his. Do it only if it suits you. I have no more to say about this business." It was then that, with sudden clarity, I understood what Mama had already seen. That the mask had been for Madeline's benefit, to save her embarrassment and shame. For a long time, Talia didn't make a move or say a word. Then slowly, her hands rose, and she untied the bands at the back of her head. She lowered the mask. I looked at her directly in the face. I felt an involuntary urge to recoil, the way you would at a sudden loud noise. But I didn't. I held my gaze, and I made it a point to not blink. Mama said she would homeschool me until Madeline came back, so Talia wouldn't have to stay home by herself. She gave us our lessons in the evening after dinner and assigned us homework to do in the morning while she went off to school. It sounded workable, at least in theory. But doing our studies, especially with Mama away, proved nearly impossible. News of Talia's disfigurement had spread all over the island, and people kept knocking on the door, fueled by curiosity. You would have thought that the island was suddenly running out of flour, garlic, even salt, and our house was the only place you could find it. They barely made an effort to disguise their intent. At the door, their eyes always flew over my shoulder. They craned their necks, stood on tiptoes. Most of them weren't even neighbors. They'd walk miles for a cup of sugar. Of course, I never let them in. It gave me some satisfaction to close the door on their faces. But I also felt gloomy, dispirited, aware that if I stay, my life would be too deeply touched by these people. I would, in the end, become one of them. The kids were worse and far bolder. Every day I caught one prowling outside, climbing our wall. We would be working, and Talia would tap my shoulder with her pencil, tip her chin, and I would turn to find a face, sometimes more than one, pressed to the window. It got so bad we had to go upstairs and pull all the curtains. One day I opened the door to a boy I knew from school, Petros, and three of his friends. He offered me a handful of coins for a peek. I said no. Where did he think he was? A circus? In the end, I had to tell Mama. A deep red flush marched up her face when she heard. She clenched her teeth. The next morning, she had our books and two sandwiches ready on the table. Talia understood before I did, and she curled up like a leaf. Her protest started when it came time to leave.
"Aunt Odie, no."
"Give me your hand."
"No, please."
"Go on, give it to me."
"I don't want to go."
"We are going to be late."
"Don't make me, Aunt Odie."
Mama pulled Talia up from the seat by the hands, leaned in, and fixed her with a gaze I knew well. Not a thing on this earth could deter her now. "Talia," she said, managing to sound both soft and firm, "I'm not ashamed of you." We set out, the three of us, Mama with her lips pursed, pushing forth like she was plowing against a fierce wind, her feet working quick, mincing little steps. I imagined Mama walking in the same determined manner to Madeline's father's house all those years ago, rifle in hand. People gawked and gasped as we blew past them along the winding footpaths. They stopped to stare. Some of them pointed. I tried not to look. They were a blur of pale faces and open mouths in the corners of my vision. In the schoolyard, children parted to let us pass. I heard some girls scream. Mama rolled through them like a bowling ball through pins, all but dragging Talia behind her. She shoved and pushed her way to the corner of the yard where there was a bench. She climbed the bench, helped Talia up, and then blew her whistle three times. A hush fell over the yard.
"This is Talia Giannakos,"
Mama cried.
"As of today,"
she paused,
"whoever is crying, shut your mouth before I give you reason to. Now, as of today, Talia is a student at this school. I expect all of you to treat her with decency and good manners. If I hear rumors of taunting, I will find you and I will make you sorry. You know I will. I have no more to say about this business."
She climbed down from the bench and, holding Talia's hand, headed toward the classroom. From that day forth, Talia never again wore the mask, either in public or at home. A couple of weeks before Christmas that year, we received a letter from Madeline. The shoot had run into unexpected delays. First, the director of photography, Madeline, wrote DOP, and Talia had to explain it to me and Mama, had fallen off a scaffold on the set and broken his arm in three places. Then the weather had complicated all the location shoots.
"So we are in a bit of a holding pattern, as they say. It would not be entirely a bad thing since it gives us time to work out some wrinkles in the script. If it did not also mean that we won't be reunited as I hoped. I'm crushed, my darlings. I miss you all so dearly, especially you, Talia, my love. I can only count the days until later this spring when this shoot has wrapped and we can be together again. I carry all three of you in my heart every minute of every day." "She is not coming back,"
Talia said flatly, handing the letter back to Mama.
"Of course she is,"
I said, dumbfounded. I turned to Mama, waiting for her to say something, at least pipe a word of encouragement. But Mama folded the letter, put it on the table, and quietly went to boil water for coffee. And I remember thinking how thoughtless it was of her to not comfort Talia, even if she agreed that Madeline wasn't coming back. But I didn't know, not yet, that they already understood each other, perhaps better than I did either of them. Mama respected Talia too much to coddle her. She would not insult Talia with false assurances. Spring came in all its flush green glory and went. We received from Madeline one postcard and what felt like a hastily written letter, in which she informed us of more troubles on the set, this time having to do with financiers who were threatening to balk because of all the delays. In this letter, unlike the last, she did not set a timeline as to when she would come back. One warm afternoon early in the summer, that would be 1968, Talia and I went to the beach with a girl named Dory. By then, Talia had lived with us on Tinas for a year, and her disfigurement no longer drew whispers and lingering stares. She was still, and always would be, girded by an orb of curiosity, but even that was waning. She had friends of her own now, Dory among them, who were no longer spooked by her appearance, friends with whom she ate lunch, gossiped, played after school, did her studies. She had become, improbably enough, almost ordinary, and I had to admit to a degree of admiration for the way the islanders had accepted her as one of their own. That afternoon, the three of us had planned to swim, but the water was still too cold, and we had ended up lying on the rocks, dozing off. When Talia and I came home, we found Mama in the kitchen peeling carrots. Another letter sat unopened on the table.
"It's from your stepfather,"
Mama said. Talia picked up the letter and went upstairs. It was a long time before she came down. She dropped the sheet of paper on the table, sat down, picked up a knife and a carrot.
He wants me to come home.
I see, Mama said. I thought I heard the faintest flutter in her voice.
Not home exactly. He said he has contacted a private school in England. I could enroll in the fall. He'd paid for it, he said.
What about Aunt Madeline? I asked.
She's gone with Elias. They've eloped.
What about the film?
Mama and Talia exchanged a glance and simultaneously tipped their gaze up toward me. And I saw what they knew all along. One morning in 2002, more than 30 years later, around the time I'm preparing to move from Athens to Kabul, I stumble upon Madeline's obituary in the newspaper. Her last name is listed now as Kuris, but I recognize in the old woman's face a familiar bright-eyed grin, a more than detritus of her youthful beauty. The small paragraph below says that she had briefly been an actress in her youth prior to founding her own theater company in the early 1980s. Her company had received critical praise for several productions, most notably for extended runs of Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey into Night in the mid-1990s, Chekhov's The Seagull, and Dimitrios Bogris's Engagement. The obituary says she was well known among Athens's artistic community for her charity work, her wit, her sense of style, her lavish parties, and her willingness to take chances on unheralded playwrights. The piece says she died after a lengthy battle with emphysema, but makes no mention of a surviving spouse or children. I'm further stunned to learn that she lived in Athens for more than two decades, at a house barely six blocks from my own place on Kolonaki. I put down the paper. To my surprise, I feel a tinge of impatience with this dead woman I have not seen for over 30 years. A surge of resistance to the story of how she had turned out. I had always pictured her living a tumultuous, wayward life, hard years of bad luck, fits and starts, collapse, regrets, and ill-advised, desperate love affairs. I'd always imagined that she had self-destructed, likely drank herself to the kind of early death that people always call tragic. Part of me had even credited her with the possibility that she had known this, that she had brought Talia to Tinos to spare her, rescue her from the disasters Madeline knew she was helpless from visiting upon her daughter. But now I picture Madeline the way Mama always must have. Madeline, the cartographer, sitting down, calmly drawing the map of her future and neatly excluding her burdensome daughter from its borders. And she had succeeded spectacularly, at least according to this obituary and its clipped account of a mannered life. A life rich with achievement, grace, respect. I find I cannot accept it. The success, they're getting away with it. It's preposterous. Where was the toll, the exacting comeuppance? And yet, as I fold the newspaper, a nagging doubt begins to set in, a faint intimation that I have judged Madeline harshly, that we weren't even that different, she and I. Hadn't we both yearned for escape, reinvention, new identities? Hadn't we each in the end unmoored ourselves by cutting loose the anchors that weigh us down? I scoff at this, tell myself we are nothing alike, even as I sense that the anger I feel toward her may really be a mask for my envy over her succeeding at it all better than I had. I toss the newspaper. If Talia is going to find out, it won't be from me. Mama pushed the carrot shavings off the table with a knife and collected them in a bowl. She loathed when people wasted food. She would make a jar of marmalade with the shavings.
Well, you have a big decision to make, Talia, she said.
Talia surprised me by turning to me and saying,
What would you do, Marcus?
Oh, I know what he would do,
Mama said quickly.
I would go,
I said, answering Talia, looking at Mama, taking satisfaction in playing the insurrectionist that Mama thought I was. Of course, I meant it too. I couldn't believe Talia would even hesitate. I would have leapt at the chance. A private education? In London?
You should think about it,
Mama said.
I already have,
Talia said hesitantly. Then even more hesitant, as she raised her eyes to meet Mama's.
But I don't want to assume.
Mama put down the knife. I heard a faint expulsion of breath. Had she been holding it? If so, her stoic face betrayed no sign of relief.
The answer is yes. Of course it's yes.
Talia reached across the table and touched Mama's wrist.
Thank you, Aunt Odie.
I only say this once, I said. I think this is a mistake. You're both making a mistake. They turned to look at me.
Do you want me to go, Marcus? Talia said.
Yes,
I said.
I would miss you a lot, and you know that, but you can't pass up a private school education. You would go to university afterward. You could become a researcher, a scientist, a professor, an inventor. Isn't that what you want? You're the smartest person I know. You could be anything you want.
I broke off.
No, Marcus,
Talia said heavily.
No, I couldn't.
She said this with a thudding finality that sealed off all channels of rebuttal. Many years later, when I began training as a plastic surgeon, I understood something that I had not that day in the kitchen arguing for Talia to leave Tina's for the boarding school. I learned that the world didn't see the inside of you, that didn't care a whit about the hopes and dreams and sorrows that lay masked by skin and bone. It was as simple, as absurd, and as cruel as that. My patients knew this. They saw that much of what they were, would be, or could be hinged on the symmetry of their bone structure, the space between their eyes, their chin length, the tip projection of their nose, whether they had an ideal nasofrontal angle or not. Beauty is an enormous, unmerited gift given randomly, stupidly. And so I chose my specialty to even out the odds for people like Talia, to rectify, with each slice of my scalpel, an arbitrary injustice, to make a small stand against a world order I found disgraceful. One in which a dog bite could rob a little girl of her future, make her an outcast, an object of scorn. At least this is what I tell myself. I suppose there were other reasons I chose plastic surgery. Money, for instance, prestige, social standing. To say I chose it solely because of Talia is too simple. Lovely as the idea may be, a bit too orderly and balanced. If I've learned anything in Kabul, it is that human behavior is messy and unpredictable, and unconcerned with convenient symmetries. But I find comfort in it, in the idea of a pattern, of a narrative of my life taking shape, like a photograph in a dark room, a story that slowly emerges and affirms the good that I've always wanted to see in myself. It sustains me, this story. I spent half of my practice in Athens, erasing wrinkles, lifting eyebrows, stretching jowls, reshaping misbegotten noses. I spent the other half doing what I really wanted to, which was to fly around the world, to Central America, to Sub-Saharan Africa, to South Asia, and to the Far East, and work on children, repairing cleft lips and palates, removing facial tumors, repairing injuries to their faces. The work in Athens was not nearly as gratifying, but the pay was good, and it afforded me the luxury of taking weeks and months off at the time for my volunteer work. Then, early in 2002, I took a phone call in my office from a woman I knew. Her name was Amra Adamović. She was a nurse from Bosnia. She and I had met at a conference in London a few years back and had had a pleasant weekend-long thing that we had mutually kept inconsequential, though we had remained in touch and seen each other socially on occasion. She says she was working for a non-profit in Kabul now and that they were searching for a plastic surgeon to work on children, cleft lips, facial injuries inflicted by shrapnel and bullets, that sort of thing. I agreed on spot. I intended to stay for 3 months. I went late in the spring of 2002. I never came back. Talia picks me up from the ferry port. She has on a green wool scarf and a thick, dull rose-colored coat over a cardigan sweater and jeans. She wears her hair long these days, loose over the shoulders and parted in the center. Her hair is white, and it is this future, not the mutilated lower face, that jars me and takes me aback when I see her. Not that it surprises me. Talia started going gray in her mid-30s and had cotton white hair by the end of the following decade. I know I've changed too. The stubbornly growing punch, the just as determined retreat of the hairline, but the decline of one's own body is incremental, as nearly imperceptible as it is insidious. Seeing Talia white-haired presents jolting evidence of her steady, inevitable march toward old age, and by association, my own.
"You're going to be cold,"
she says, tightening the scarf around her neck. It's January, late morning, the sky overcast and gray. A cool breeze makes the shriveled-up leaves clatter in the trees. "You want cold? Come to Kabul," I say. I pick up my suitcase. "Suit yourself, doctor. Bus or walk? Your choice." "Let's walk," I say. We head north. We pass through Tinas town. The sailboats and yachts moored in the inner harbor. The kiosks selling postcards and t-shirts. People sipping coffee at the little round tables outside cafes, reading newspapers, playing chess. Waiters setting out silverware for lunch. Another hour or two, and the smell of cooking fish will waft from kitchens. Talia launches energetically into a story about the new set of whitewashed bungalows that developers are building south of Tinas town, with views of Mykonos and the Aegean. Primarily, they will be filled with either tourists or the wealthy summer residents who have been coming to Tinas since the 1990s. She says the bungalows will have an outdoor pool and a fitness center. She has been emailing me for years, chronicling for me these changes that are reshaping Tinas. The beachside hotels with the satellite dishes and dial-up access, the nightclubs and bars and taverns, the restaurants and shops that cater to tourists, the cabs, the buses, the crowds, the foreign women who lie topless at the beaches. The farmers ride pickup trucks now instead of donkeys, at least the farmers who stayed. Most of them left long ago, though some are coming back now to live out their retirement on the island. "Odie's none to please," Talia says, meaning with the transformation. She has written to me about this too, the older islanders' suspicion of the newcomers and the changes they are importing. "You don't seem to mind the change," I say. "No point in griping about the inevitable," she says, then adds, "Odie says, well, it figures you'd say that, Talia. You weren't born here." She lets out a loud, hearty laugh. "You think after 44 years on Tinas, I would have earned the right, but there you have it." Talia has changed too. Even with the winter coat on, I can tell she has thickened in the hips, become plumper, not soft plump, sturdy plump. There is a cordial defiance to her now, a slyly teasing way she has of commenting on things I do that I suspect she finds slightly foolish. The brightness in her eyes, this new hearty laugh, the perpetual flush of the cheeks. The overall impression is a farmer's wife. A salt-of-the-earth kind of woman whose robust friendliness hints at a bracing authority and hardness you might be unwise to question. "How's business?" I ask. "Are you still working?"
"Here and there,"
Talia says.
"You know the times."
We both shake our heads. In Kabul, I had followed news about the rounds of austerity measures. I'd watched on CNN masked young Greeks stoning police outside the parliament, cops in riot gear firing tear gas, swinging their batons. Talia doesn't run a business in the real sense. Before the digital age, she was essentially a handywoman. She went to people's homes and soldered power transistors in their TVs, replaced signal capacitors in old tube model radios. She was called in to fix faulty refrigerator thermostats, seal leaky plumbing. People paid her what they could, and if they couldn't afford to pay, she did the work anyway.
"I don't really need the money," she said. "I do it for the game of it. There is still a thrill for me in opening things up and seeing how they work inside."
These days, she's like a freelance one-woman IT department. Everything she knows is self-taught. She charges nominal fees to troubleshoot people's PCs, change IP settings, fix their application file freeze-ups, their slowdowns, their upgrade, and boot-up failures. More than once, I've called her from Kabul, desperate for help with my frozen IBM. When we arrived at my mother's house, we stand outside for a moment in the courtyard beside the old olive tree. I see evidence of Mama's recent frenzy of work, the repainted walls, the half-finished dovecot, a hammer and an open box of nails resting on a slab of wood. "How is she?" I ask.
"Oh, thorny as ever. That's why I had that thing installed."
She points to a satellite dish perched on the roof.
"We watch foreign soaps. The Arabic ones are the best or the worst, which comes down to the same thing. We try to figure out the plots. It keeps her claws off me."
She charges through the front door.
"Welcome home. I will fix you something to eat."
It's strange being back in this house. I see a few unfamiliar things, like the gray leather armchair in the living room and a white wicker end table beside the TV. But everything else is more or less where it used to be. The kitchen table, now covered by a vinyl top with an alternating pattern of eggplants and pears. The straight-back bamboo chairs. The old oil lamp with the wicker holder. The scalloped chimney stained black with smoke. The picture of me and Mama, me in the white shirt, Mama in her good dress, still hanging above the mantel in the living room. Mama's set of china still on the high shelf. And yet, as I drop my suitcase, it feels as though there is a gaping hole in the middle of everything. The decades of my mother's life here with Talia, they are dark, vast spaces to me. I've been absent. Absent for all the meals Talia and Mama have shared at this table. The laughs, the quarrels, the stretches of boredom, the illnesses, the long string of simple rituals that make up a lifetime. Entering my childhood home is a little disorienting, like reading the end of a novel that I've started, then abandoned long ago. "How about some eggs?" Talia says, already donning a print bib apron, pouring oil in a skillet. She moves about the kitchen with command, in a proprietary way.
"Sure, where is Mama?"
"Asleep, she had a rough night." "I'll take a quick look." Talia fishes a whisk from the drawer.
"You wake her up, you answer to me, doctor."
I tiptoe up the steps to the bedroom. The room is dark. A single long narrow slab of light shoots through the pulled curtains, slashes across Mama's bed. The air is heavy with sickness. It's not quite a smell, rather it's like a physical presence. Every doctor knows this. Sickness permeates a room like steam. I stand at the entrance for a moment and allow my eyes to adjust. The darkness is broken by a rectangle of shifting color light on the dresser on what I take to be Talia's side of the bed, my old side. It's one of those digital picture frames. A field of rice paddies and wooden houses with gray tiled roofs fade to a crowded bazaar with skinned goats hanging from hooks, then to a dark-skinned man squatting by a muddy river, finger-brushing his teeth. I pull up a chair and sit at Mama's bedside. Looking at her, now that my eyes have adjusted, I feel something in me drop. I'm startled by how much my mother has shrunk already. The floral print pajamas appear loose around her small shoulders over the flattened chest. I don't care for the way she's sleeping, with her mouth open and turned down, as though she is having a sour dream. I don't like seeing that her dentures have slid out of place in her sleep. Her eyelids flutter slightly. I sit there a while. I ask myself, what did you expect? And I listen to the clock ticking on the wall, the clanging of Talia's spatula against the frying pan from downstairs. I take inventory of the banal details of Mama's life in this room. The flat-screen TV fastened to the wall, the PC in the corner, the unfinished game of Sudoku on the nightstand, the page marked by a pair of reading glasses, the TV remote, the vial of artificial tears, a tube of steroid cream, a tube of denture glue, a small bottle of pills, and on the floor, an oyster-colored pair of fuzzy slippers. She would have never worn those before. Beside the slippers, an open bag of pull-on diapers. I cannot reconcile these things with my mother. I resist them. They look to me like the belongings of a stranger. Someone indolent, harmless. Someone with whom you could never be angry. Across the bed, the image on the digital picture frame shifts again. I track a few. Then it comes to me. I know these photos. I shot them. Back when I was, what, walking the earth, I suppose. I'd always made sure to get double prints and mail one set to Talia. And she had kept them. All these years. Talia. Affection seeps through me, sweet as honey. She has been my true sister, my true Menar, all along. She calls my name from downstairs. I get up quietly. As I leave the room, something catches my eye. Something framed, mounted on the wall beneath the clock. I can't quite make it out in the dark. I open my cell phone and take a look in its silver glow. It's an AP story about the nonprofit I work with in Kabul. I remember the interview. The journalist was a pleasant Korean-American fellow with a mild stutter. We had shared a plate of kabuli, Afghan pilaf with brown rice, raisins, lamb. There is in the center of the story a group photo. Me, some of the children, Nabi in the back, standing rigidly, hands behind his back, looking simultaneously foreboding, shy, and dignified, as Afghans often manage to in pictures. Amra is there too, with her adopted daughter, Roshi. All the children are smiling. Marcos! I flip the mobile close and make my way downstairs. Talia puts before me a glass of milk and a steaming plate of eggs on a bed of tomatoes. Don't worry, I already sugared the milk. You remember? She takes a seat, not bothering to remove the apron. She rests her elbows on the table and watches me eat, dabbing now and then at her left cheek with a handkerchief. I remember all the times I tried to convince her to let me work on her face. I told her that surgical techniques had come a long way since the 1960s, and that I was certain I could, if not fix, then at least significantly improve her disfigurement. Talia refused to enormous bewilderment on my part.
"This is who I am," she said to me.
An insipid, unsatisfactory answer, I thought at the time. What did that even mean? I didn't understand it. I had uncharitable thoughts of prison inmates, lifers, afraid to get out, terrified of being paroled, terrified of change, terrified of facing a new life outside barbed wire and guard towers. My offer to Talia still stands to this day. I know she won't take it, but I understand now, because she was right. This is who she is. I cannot pretend to know what it must have been like to gaze at that face in the mirror each day, to take stock of its ghastly ruin, and to summon the will to accept it. The mountainous strain of it, the effort, the patience. Her acceptance taking shape slowly, over years, like rocks of a beachside cliff sculpted by the pounding tides. It took the dog minutes to give Talia her face, and a lifetime for her to mold it into an identity. She would not let me undo it all with my scalpel. It would be like inflicting a fresh wound over the old one. I dig into the eggs, knowing it will please her, even though I am not really hungry.
It is good, Talia.
So, are you excited?
What do you mean?
She reaches behind her and pulls open a kitchen counter drawer. She retrieves a pair of sunglasses with rectangular lenses. It takes me a moment. Then I remember. The eclipse.
Of course.
At first, she says, I thought we would watch it through a pinhole, but then Odie said you were coming, and I said, well, then let's do it in style. We talk a bit about the eclipse and that it's supposed to happen the next day. Talia says it will start in the morning and be complete by noon or so. She has been checking the weather updates and is relieved that the island is not due for a cloudy day. She asks if I want more eggs, and I say yes. And she tells me about the new internet cafe that has gone up where Mr. Russo's old pawn shop used to sit. I saw the pictures, I say, upstairs, the article too. She wipes my breadcrumbs off the table with her palm, tosses them over her shoulder into the kitchen sink without looking.
Oh, that was easy. Well, scanning and uploading them was. The hard part was organizing them into countries. I had to sit and figure it out because you never send notes, just the pictures. She was very specific about that, the having it organized into countries. She had to have it that way. She insisted on it.
Who?
She issues a sigh.
Who, he says. Odie. Who else?
That was her idea?
The article too. She was the one who found it on the web.
Mama looked me up,
I say. I should have never taught her. Now she won't stop.
She gives a chuckle.
She checks on you every day. It's true. You have yourself a cyberspace stalker, Marcus Barbares.
Mama comes downstairs early in the afternoon. She's wearing a dark blue bathrobe and the fuzzy slippers that I've already come to loathe. It looks like she has brushed her hair. I'm relieved to see that she appears to be moving normally as she walks down the steps, as she opens her arms to me, smiling sleepily. We sit at the table for coffee.
Where is Talia?
She asks, blowing into her cup. Out to get some treats for tomorrow? Is that yours, Mama? I point to a cane leaning against the wall behind the new armchair. I hadn't noticed it when I had first come in.
Oh, I hardly use it, just for bad days and for long walks. Even then, mostly for peace of mind.
She says too dismissively, which is how I know she relies on it far more than she lets on.
It's you I worry for.
the news from that awful country. Talia doesn't want me listening to it. She says it will agitate me.
We do have our incidents, I say, but mostly it's just people going about their lives, and I'm always careful, Mama. Of course, I neglect to tell her about the shooting at the guest house across the street, or the recent surge in attacks on foreign aid workers. Or that by careful, I mean I have taken to carrying a 9mm when I'm out driving around the city, which I probably shouldn't be doing in the first place. Mama takes a sip of coffee, winces a bit. She doesn't push me. I'm not sure whether this is a good thing. Not sure whether she has drifted off, descended into herself as old people do, or whether it is a tactic to not corner me into lying or disclosing things that would only upset her.
"We missed you at Christmas," she says.
"I couldn't get away, Mama." She nods.
"You are here now. That's what matters."
I take a sip of my coffee. I remember when I was little, Mama and me eating breakfast at this table every morning, quietly, almost solemnly, before we walked to school together. We said so little to each other. "You know, Mama, I worry for you too."
"No need to. I take care of myself all right."
A flash of the old defiant pride, like a dim glint in the fog. "But for how long?"
"As long as I can."
"And when you can't, then what?" I'm not challenging her. I ask because I don't know. I don't know what my own role will be, or whether I will even play one. She levels her gaze at me evenly. Then she adds a teaspoon of sugar to her cup, slowly stirs it in.
"It's a funny thing, Marcus. Most people have it backwards. They think they live by what they want. But really what guides them is what they are afraid of, what they don't want."
"I don't follow, Mama."
Well, take you, for instance. Leaving here. The life you have made for yourself. You were afraid to be confined here, with me. You were afraid I would hold you back. Or take Talia. She stayed because she didn't want to be stared at anymore."
I watch her taste her coffee, pouring another spoonful of sugar. I remember how out of my depth I'd always felt as a boy trying to argue with her. She spoke in a way that left no room for retort. Steam rolling over me with truth, told right at the outset, plainly, directly. I was always defeated before I'd so much as said a word. It always seemed unfair. "What about you, Mama?" I ask. "What are you scared of? What don't you want?"
"To be a burden."
"You won't be."
"Oh, you're right about that, Marcus."
This quiet spreads through me at this cryptic remark. My mind flashes to the letter Nabi had given me in Kabul, his posthumous confession, the pact Suleiman Wahdati had made with him. I can't help but wonder if Mama has forged a similar pact with Talia, if she has chosen Talia to rescue her when the time comes. I know Talia could do it. She's strong now. She would save Mama. Mama is studying my face.
"You have your life and your work, Marcus,"
she says more softly now, redirecting the course of the conversation, as if she has peeked into my mind, spotted my worry. The dentures, the diapers, the fuzzy slippers, they have made me underestimate her. She still has the upper hand. She always will.
"I don't want to weigh you down."
At last, a lie. This last thing she says, but it's a kind lie. This isn't me she would weigh down. She knows this as well as I do. I am absent, thousands of miles away. The unpleasantness, the work, the drudgery, it would fall on Talia. But Mama is including me, granting me something I have not earned, nor tried to. It wouldn't be like that, I said weakly. Mama smiles.
Speaking of your work, I guess you know that I didn't exactly approve when you decided to go to that country.
I had my suspicions, yes.
I didn't understand why you would go. Why would you give everything up? The practice, the money, the house in Athens, all you'd work for, and hole up in that violent place?
I had my reasons.
I know.
She raises the cup to her lips, lowers it without sipping.
I'm no damn good at this,
she says slowly, almost shyly.
But what I'm getting around to telling you is, you turned out good. You have made me proud, Marcus.
I look down at my hands. I feel her words landing deep within me. She has startled me, cut me unprepared, for what she said or for the soft light in her eyes when she said it. I am at a loss as to what I'm expected to say in response. Thank you, Mama, I manage to mutter. I can't say anymore, and we sit quietly for a while. The air between us thick with awkwardness and our awareness of all the time lost. The opportunities frittered away.
I've been meaning to ask you something,
Mama says. What is it?
James Parkinson's, George Huntington, Robert Graves, John Downe. Now this Lou Gehrig fellow of mine. How did men come to monopolize disease names too?
I blink and my mother blinks back. And then she is laughing, and so am I, even as I crumple inside. The next morning we lie outside on lounge chairs. Mama wears a thick scarf and a gray parka, her legs warm against the sharp chill by a fleece blanket. We sip coffee and nibble on bits of the cinnamon-flavored Beck Quince Talia has bought for the occasion. We are wearing our eclipse glasses, looking up at the sky. The sun has a small bite taken from its northern rim, looking somewhat like the logo on the Apple laptop Talia periodically opens to post remarks on an online forum. Up and down the street, people have settled on the sidewalks and rooftops to watch the spectacle. Some have taken their families to the other side of the island, where the Hellenic Astronomical Society has set up telescopes. What time is it supposed to peak? I ask.
Close to 10:30,
Talia says. She lifts her glasses, checks her watch.
Another hour or so.
She rubs her hands with excitement, taps something on the keyboard. I watch the two of them. Mama with her dark glasses, blue-veined hands laced on her chest, Talia furiously pounding keys, white hair spilling from under her beanie cap.
You have turned out good.
I lay on the couch the night before thinking about what Mama had said, and my thoughts had wandered to Madeline. I remembered how, as a boy, I would stew over all the things Mama wouldn't do, things other mothers did. Hold my hand when we walked, sit me up on her lap, read bedtime stories, kiss my face goodnight. Those things were true enough, but all those years I'd been blind to a greater truth, which lay unacknowledged and unappreciated, buried deep beneath my grievances. It was this, that my mother would never leave me. This was her gift to me. The ironclad knowledge that she would never do to me what Madeline had done to Talia. She was my mother, and she would not leave me. This I had simply accepted and expected. I had no more thanked her for it than I did the sun for shining on me.
Look!
Talia exclaims. Suddenly all around us, on the ground, on the walls, on our clothing, little shining sickles of light have materialized. The crescent-shaped sun beaming through the leaves of our olive tree. I find a crescent shimmering on the coffee inside my mug, another dancing on my shoelaces.
Show me your hands, Odie,
Talia says.
Quick!
Mama opens her hands, palms up. Talia fetches from her pocket a square of cut glass. She holds it over Mama's hands. Suddenly, little crescent rainbows quiver on the wrinkled skin of my mother's hands. She gasps.
Look at that, Marcus!
Mama says, grinning unabashedly with delight like a schoolgirl. I've never before seen her smile this purely, this guilelessly. We sit, the three of us, washing the trembling little rainbows on my mother's hand. And I feel sadness and an old ache, each like a claw at my throat.
You have turned out good. You have made me proud, Marcus.
I am 55 years old. I've waited all my life to hear those words. Is it too late now for this? For us? Have we squandered too much for too long, Mama and I? Part of me thinks it is better to go on as we have. To act as though we don't know how ill-suited we have been for each other. Less painful that way. Perhaps better than this belated offering. This fragile, trembling little glimpse of how it could have been between us. All it will beget is regret, I tell myself, and what good is regret? It brings back nothing. What we have lost is irretrievable. And yet when my mother says,
Isn't it beautiful, Marcus?
I say to her, It is, Mama. It is beautiful. And as something begins to break wide open inside me, I reach over and take my mother's hand in mine.
Chapter 9, Winter 2010. When I was a little girl, my father and I had a nightly ritual. After I'd said my 21 bismillahs and he had tucked me into bed, he would sit at my side and pluck bad dreams from my head with his thumb and forefinger. His fingers would hop from my forehead to my temples, patiently searching behind my ears, at the back of my head, and he'd make a pop sound, like a bottle being uncorked. With each nightmare, he purged from my brain. He stashed the dreams, one by one, into an invisible sack in his lap, and pulled the drawstring tightly. He would then scour the air, looking for happy dreams to replace the ones he had sequestered away. I watched as he cocked his head slightly and frowned, his eyes roaming side to side, like he was straining to hear distant music. I held my breath, waiting for the moment when my father's face unfurled into a smile. When he sang, Ah, here's one, when he cupped his hands, let the dream land in his palms like a petal. Slowly twirling down from a tree. Gently then, so very gently. My father said all good things in life were fragile and easily lost. He would raise his hands to my face, rub his palms against my brow, and happiness into my head. What am I going to dream about tonight, Baba? I asked. Oh, tonight. Well, tonight is a special one. He always said before going on to tell me about it. He would make up story on the spot. In one of the dreams he gave me, I had become the world's most famous painter. In another, I was the queen of an enchanted island, and I had a flying throne. He even gave me one about my favorite dessert, Jello. I had the power to, with a wave of my wand, turn anything into Jello, a school bus. The Empire State Building, the entire Pacific Ocean, if I liked. More than once, I saved the planets from destruction by waving my wand at a crashing meteor. My father, who never spoke much about his own father, said it was from him that he had inherited his storytelling ability. He said that when he was a boy, his father